Hello, I'm Mike Derby. I'm a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. I'm part of the team we have covering the Federal Reserve, and so I'll be moderating this panel. And we will be talking about the U.S. growth and unemployment outlook. And it's obviously a fairly interesting time to hold this panel because we're at a point where the economy has been expanding for, you know, a fairly substantial amount of time, but there's a lot of discontent with the quality of the recovery, where we stand with it. A lot of that discontent, I suppose, could be seen in the outcome of the election. And so with that in mind, you know, it's a fairly interesting time in terms of, you know, unemployment has declined a lot from its peak, but right now a lot of, you know, Fed officials in particular are struggling with, you know, is the sort of job market we have as good a job market we can have, or can we get better? Is it possible to have a lower unemployment rate without causing the sort of inflation fears that they have problems with? And the inflation issue has also been interesting as well because, you know, we've had years of inflation undershooting the Fed's 2% target, and it only seems now that we're starting to get up where the Fed would like it to be. But, you know, it's still a very tentative thing. And so in that climate, you know, the Federal Reserve is in a very interesting time, and we have had some interest rate increases. We're finally seem to be in a position where there might be more interest rate increases over the rest of the year. And when we heard from Esther George speaking early this morning, we were talked about how the balance sheet might finally be reduced this year. And so there's a lot of moving pieces with the economy right now. And then, you know, the topic of the conference is America First, and obviously that comes from President Trump. And, you know, he is a president that is, it's hard to know what he's going to do. And all of that, you know, will he be a protectionist or a pragmatist? Will he be effective or hapless? We don't know. But so I guess with that in mind, we'll go ahead and start. And we're going to start with Mr. Akshay, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for having me back. It means I didn't offend too much last time, I guess, which is nice. America First in perspective is what I'd like to talk about. Keying off the theme of this year's conference. And of course, as mentioned, that's how the Trump administration plans to make America great again. Now, that really means getting the U.S. back to the economic dominance that it enjoyed several decades ago, toward the middle of the 20th century. And to put that economic dominance in perspective, I'd like to, I think it's instructive, to take a very long view of history and then zoom in a bit. So I'd like to look at three different time frames. First, and when I mean long view, I really mean long view, the last two millennia, and in particular the last two centuries. Second, the 21st century, including the next several years to come. And then finally, the near-term cyclical outlook for the next couple of quarters. So perspective, of course, is a funny thing. You may recognize this cartoon of a New Yorker's view of the world. It shows 9th Avenue. I think this is... Yeah, 76, so it's some of you may not recognize it. It shows 9th and 10th Avenues in great detail in the foreground, then the Hudson River, a thin strip that is New Jersey, the rest of America and the Pacific Ocean all scrunched up together, and barely visible on the far horizon, you have Asia, right? Okay, this quite reasonably describes many people's subjective reality, but it's also a highly distorted view. It's wildly exaggerating the importance of the near at the expense of the far. And so it is with our sense of history. Because again, perspective is a funny thing. So I'd like to start off from Angus Madison's life work. We have economic data going back over 2,000 years. And here's how that data is typically summarized. I just lifted the main chart on Angus Madison's Wikipedia page and posted it here. Around the middle of the chart, So around the middle of the chart, you see the decline of China and India, and the rise of, Europe and then the U.S. And towards the end of the chart, you see those trends reverse a little bit, and the end of the chart is at 2003. But please notice that, like the New Yorker cartoon, it wildly overemphasizes the near at the expense of the far. 1,000 years on the left of the chart occupies the same space as 30 years on the right. Now, instead, having updated the Madison data through last year, this next chart shifts the historical perspective to properly show the passage of time. What becomes clear is that for more than 90% of these two millennia, China and India together dominated the world economy, accounting for about half or more of global GDP in terms of real purchasing power. In year one, all the way at the left, India's share was nearly a third of global GDP, and China's was over a quarter, both bigger than the Roman Empire. Asia as a whole produced almost three-quarters. Asia's basically from the red down. Almost three-quarters of all global output at that point. So 1,000 years later, which is the middle of the chart, those percentages had only declined a little. Of course, the main point of this chart is that China and India dominated the world economy for the vast majority of this period until a couple of centuries ago. And then there were huge shifts with the rise of the West, which is shown in the blues. And the West dominated the global economy by the middle of the 20th century. But as it's clear to see, that historical moment was the exception in the long history of world GDP. So before I move on, please take a second to appreciate just how breathtakingly fast the rise of the West was and how equally swift the reversal of fortune has been. So now let's zoom in on the last two centuries of very rapid change. So, of course, we have in Europe's Industrial Revolution, which started in the late 1700s, not on the chart, and soon spread to the U.S. That's part of what's going on, in combination with Western colonial exploitation. That was really what was responsible for the plunge in India and China's share of world GDP between the early 18th and mid-20th century. So in a span of just 130 years, from 1820 to 1950, so 1820 is when the chart starts through 1950, the GDP share of Asia, excluding the Middle East, plummeted from almost 60% to only 16%. So it's starting off here and it comes all the way down. It's quite the fall. By the end of World War II, the U.S. reigned supreme. So World War II end is right about here, commanding over a third of world GDP. And taken together with Western Europe, that accounted for 57% of global GDP. All those blues up to here. So the mid-20th century saw the GDP share of the West at its zenith, with America dominating the West for decades thereafter. So today, when people say, make America great again, they're really harking back to this period. For Asia, excluding the Middle East, the comeback started pretty slowly between 1950 and 1980. And the climb then accelerated, with that share surging past 30% by the turn of the century, which is here, and standing at 43% today, which is a 160-year high. Meanwhile, the combined share of the U.S. and Western Europe has fallen to just a third, which is a 166-year low. And the U.S. share is now half. So the U.S. is just the blue here. It's half of what it used to be at the mid-20th century peak. So it's the pace of that decline that's really worthy of notice as we're thinking about today. The very far right side of the chart, here's 2000, and then you go on another 15 or so years. That's when the pace of change has really speeded up. Just since the start of this century, Western Europe has lost nearly a third of its global GDP share, while the U.S. has lost more than a fifth since the start of the century. This is similar to the fastest periods of decline for China and India back in the day. So it's this swift swing of the pendulum back from that mid-20th century extreme that really provides some important, I think necessary, historical perspective. And remember, the two key factors driving the rise of the West relative to others through the mid-20th century were the Industrial Revolution and colonialism. But then we've seen the twilight of colonialism, followed in recent decades by a great deal of technological catch-up in China and in India, and that is not over. So, has the relative decline of the West and the rise of the rest really run its course? If not, it's going to be a very tall order for the U.S. to get back to more than a third of world GDP, or even the 22% share averaged over the Reagan years. And so you see the decline, and then here's roughly the Reagan years. A little bit of a slowdown in the decline. And so even if that's the benchmark. Now, in recent years, the last few years, annual world GDP growth, excluding the U.S., has been running at 3.7% a year, while U.S. GDP growth has been running at just over 2% a year. So it follows that in order for the U.S. to gain back any GDP share, it needs to grow at almost twice its 2% rate on a sustained basis. So how likely is that? Now, the decline in America's dominance in the 21st century has been driven partly by the resurgence of China and India, but it's also the fact that U.S. trend growth has really downshifted. And on that point, it's instructive to revisit the simple math behind potential GDP growth that I've discussed at previous conferences. So in 2008, and this is pre-Lehman, we first identified the long-term decline in trend growth in the U.S. And subsequently, we explained that decline by using the simple math captured in this chart, which is in the simple math behind potential GDP growth, namely that it's the sum of productivity growth and potential labor force growth. And so this chart begins in the middle of the 20th century and shows potential labor force growth as the bottom blue line, which the CBO, so this bottom panel is potential labor force, the CBO projects that will grow projects the average under 0.5% per year for the next 6 years. And I've marked that off by the horizontal red line here. And that's pretty much set in stone, given the demographics. Now, productivity growth for the past 6 years has averaged 0.5% a year. And that's marked off by the horizontal red line on the right-hand side of the top panel. And that is obviously far below this post-World War II through 2008 average of 2.25%. So we've been making the point at ECRI for some time that productivity growth is unlikely to rise materially from the last 6 years' average over the next several years. And it's not that productivity growth cannot rise at some point in the future, merely that it's unlikely to do so anytime soon. So you have the CBO's potential labor force growth of 0.5%, and the latest 6 year average of 0.5% of productivity growth. Adding those up, you get 1% longer term real GDP growth. And since potential labor force growth over the next several years is, as I said, set in stone, in order to achieve the, quote, sustained 3-4% GDP growth, unquote, promised by Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, we would need to see 6 times the last 6 years' productivity growth. So that's what the goal is. And to put that in perspective, because I know we sometimes hark back to the Reagan years as something to go for, that would be twice the productivity growth that we saw then. Okay, so then the other side of this coin is immigration, and that's also a key element of the Trump policy agenda. And what that suggests is that even this potential labor force growth is not guaranteed. Undocumented workers aside, legal immigration accounts for the bulk of U.S. labor force growth. So of the 0.5% per year potential labor force growth for the coming years, legal immigrants account for 2/3. So if net immigration, for example, were to go to zero, potential labor force growth would be cut to less than 0.2% per year. And that's the lower purple horizontal line. Okay, so simple math, adding that to 0.5%, you get 0.7% potential GDP growth. In other words, diminished legal immigration, let alone massive deportation of undocumented immigrants, could significantly reduce potential GDP growth for the coming years. So in 2009, building on this earlier work, we showed that the structural downshift in trend growth went well beyond the United States and was also taking place in all the other major economies. And once again, this was because of the simple math of demographics and productivity growth. So bear with me on this chart. This is last year I showed a 3D blanket of all kinds of stuff. So this is my simplified version. I'm doing a much simpler chart. Using similar data, this chart shows the so-called simple math for the G7 economies. The starting coordinate for each country's arrow is the average in the 1957 to 2007 period for productivity growth and labor force growth. So that's the starting point, 57 to 2007 average of productivity growth and labor force growth. The ending coordinates near the arrow heads are defined by the average productivity growth for the past 5 years and potential labor force growth for the next 5 years. The slanting gray lines, what you might call ISO GDP growth lines, these slanting lines, capture that simple math adding up. In other words, the sum of the horizontal and vertical coordinates of every point on the 1% line, so here's the 1% line, okay? The sum of the horizontal and vertical coordinates of every point there add up to 1%. So I can't exactly see it, but I can see it over here, like 5 and 5
0.5 and 0.5. 0.5 labor force growth, 0.5 productivity growth places us right on the 1% potential GDP line. Similar for the 0% line, which actually comes into play here. As you can see, everybody, all these countries, are headed in the wrong direction, converging toward 0 to 1% trend GDP. So those are where things are headed. The red X that's floating right here in the middle of the chart marks off Japan's lost decades from 1992, when its post-bubble recession started, to the eve of the financial crisis. All the major economies are heading for even worse predicaments. Germany's demographic problem, the next 5 years' potential labor force growth, right here, is slightly worse than even Japan's. And that may in part explain Chancellor Merkel's generosity in 2015 toward refugees, which promises to change these demographics a little bit. So what I've described here are the structural bounds that will define the growth potential of the advanced economies for the next several years. The underlying patterns in economic growth that do not change from year to year. Now, turning to cyclical issues that do change in the shorter term, things look quite different. In fact, they are the most positive that they've been in years. Now, as you may know, ECRI's co-founder, the late Jeffrey H. Moore, created the first leading indexes of recession and recovery half a century ago, which is why the Wall Street Journal called him the father of leading indicators. Since then, we've developed leading indexes for many other countries, including long leading indexes that look a bit further ahead than typical leading indicators like stock prices or PMIs. And this chart here shows the smooth growth rate of ECRI's long leading index for the G7 countries combined, and that's the top green line, which leads G7 coincident index growth, shown by the bottom blue line. Now, the G7 LLI growth is practically back up to this three-year high, and in turn, the G7 coincident index growth has also turned up. And a couple of things. By the way, this is a G7 indicator. We have a 20-country long leading index, which includes all the major emerging markets. And it's also swinging up and is, in fact, around its best reading since the global financial crisis. One other point I'd like to note is that the election is right around here. So these cyclical shifts were underway before the election. Now this is for growth, and now I'm switching to inflation. Since the early 80s, following the experience of U.S. stagflation, we've monitored leading indicators of inflation that are separate from our leading indicators of economic growth, and we call them future inflation gauges, and they measure underlying inflation pressures that anticipate cyclical turns in actual inflation. And they also typically have a short lead over inflation expectations. Now, ECRI's G7 future inflation gauge is at its highest reading since the middle of 2008, and that's shown by the top red line. And following its upturn, the G7 CPI inflation has clearly begun its own rise, a cyclical upturn, and is at its highest reading in almost 3 years. And that's the bottom black line. So one other thing, again, you can see that the future inflation gauge turned up well before all the global reflation talk that began last year. So this began moving up at the beginning of 2016. Now, in closing, I want to show a little bit about the U.S. Here we have growth in the U.S. long leading index that has been in an uptrend since last year and remains near a multi-year high. So here's the beginning of 2016. It's been running up. There's a bit of a downtick here in the most recent reading that we're keeping an eye on. The upturn in actual U.S. growth began around the middle of 2016. We have year-over-year growth in GDP at a one-year high. We'll probably edge up from there in the next reading. Industrial production growth is near a 20-month high. And as mentioned earlier, the jobless rate is at its best reading in almost a decade. But there are concerns about the hard data not being strong enough, and indeed, something is undermining real growth. Here you have the U.S. future inflation gauge, which turned up over a year ago and remains elevated. And actual inflation, as discussed earlier, has since turned up as well. Now, you can see the future inflation gauge turned up well before inflation expectations, which had actually plunged in the middle of 2016. But what is unusual about this cycle, it's atypical, is that the inflation upturn began before the cyclical upturn in growth. So real GDP and real income growth are being undercut more than usual by rising inflation. So this is part of the reason that in real, meaning inflation-adjusted terms, the so-called hard data looks relatively weak. Nevertheless, both the U.S. and the global economies are in simultaneous cyclical upturns in economic growth and inflation, and those cycle upturns are set to continue for now. So from a near-term cyclical point of view, our analysis of the outlook is unambiguously positive, period. But, there's always the but, when we expand our view to consider the next several years, because of those structural factors, potential GDP growth is seriously constrained and likely converging to around 1% a year for the U.S. And the really long view over centuries and millennia makes it painfully clear how extraordinary it was for the U.S. to achieve the economic dominance that it enjoyed several decades ago. So I would say let's enjoy our cyclical good fortune while it lasts and have the vision to recognize the longer-term reality of the global economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from Michael Feroli with J.P. Morgan.
All right, thanks, Mike, and thanks a lot, Tim. All right, so my name is Mike Feroli. I'm Chief U.S. Economist at J.P. Morgan. Naturally, a couple of my comments are going to overlap with what Lakshman said, but I think maybe one of the differences, I'll probably focus a little more near-term on the cyclical things going on in the U.S. So first, just looking back before looking forward, 2016, 2% growth. This expansion, we've averaged 2.1% growth. We think first half, we're looking at 2% growth. So that sounds all pretty bland. And it kind of has been, though, even with 2% growth, the unemployment rate declined last year. This year, we started off kind of with, once again, some renewed enthusiasm that this time's going to be different. Certainly, the sentiment measures have been quite strong. Risk assets are well bid. And the global situation certainly looks a little less foreboding than it did at this time last year. even with all that, we are tracking Q1 GDP growth. We officially have it penciled in at 1%, but it's probably looking more like 0.6, 0.7 right now. That being said, we are looking for 3% growth in Q2, which would leave first half around 2%. We already have some indications that consumption growth, which was exceptionally weak in January and February, looks like it's firming up in March. For the year, not surprisingly, we have 2% growth. Our estimate of trend or supply-side potential GDP growth is 1.4%. Just to put that in context, the median among FOMC participants has recently come down to 1.8%. Blue chip, basically consensus around Wall Street, is around a little over 2%. So we thought we were on the pessimistic side of things with a 1.4% estimate, but I guess given the first presentation, we kind of come off maybe a little more optimistic than I usually, the company I'm usually in. Regardless, if you're at 1% or 1.4%, that means if you have GDP growth at 2%, the unemployment rate should be coming lower over the course of the year, which we think validates the Fed's current expectations that they're going to hike again in June and September, and that probably in December they start to this slow process of unwinding this $4.5 trillion balance sheet. So just to put that in pictures, on the left-hand side is GDP growth butterfly charts, which basically plot GDP across several recent expansions. And you can see at this expansion, not only do you have a big recession, but you've had remarkably slow, but also remarkably steady GDP growth. In spite of that, and what's been really, I think, surprising, if you told people, gave people this chart on the left-hand side 7 or 8 years ago, they wouldn't have expected the chart on the right-hand side, which is that unemployment rate has come down to levels that are now within shelling distance of most people's estimates of what the natural rate is. So let me just start by kind of breaking down our outlook for aggregate demand before getting into aggregate supply and the inflation and Fed outlook. So let's start with consumption. On the left-hand side is an aggregate of various consumption or consumer sentiment indicators. They had been trending higher. It does appear to have spiked around the election, whether that is an election phenomena or just the fact that we were getting back to full employment right around that time. I think it's hard to disentangle. But regardless, we've seen pretty steady, you know, continuation of those trends. On the right-hand side, just one metric of the health of the household balance sheets. This is household debt. Debt to income is the top line, and then debt to overall GDP is the bottom line. We don't know what the steady state value for that is, but it certainly looks better than it did several years ago. So I think there's some reason to believe that the deleveraging process has stopped. We started to see households start to gradually take on a little more debt. Staying on the topic of the balance sheet, on the left-hand side, the blue line is household net worth as a percent of income. And you can see that right now, obviously because of the growth in both stock prices and house prices, you've had this nice move back up in the net worth to income ratio. That orange line is the saving rate inverted. So generally, people think that higher net worth leads people to lower their saving rate. However, in this expansion, for some reason, these wealth effects haven't played out like they did in the last two, if you want to call them asset price bubbles, of the dot-com boom and the housing boom. And consumers have treated this wealth or this windfall in their wealth over the past few years a little more cautiously as they've kept saving rates around 5.5%. One reason for that is that up until quite recently, consumers, this rise in wealth was not, as it has been in the past, being matched with a rise in expectations for labor income, which is on the right-hand side, and that's taken from that monthly University of Michigan sentiment survey of consumer sentiment. And so we are a little encouraged that recently it does look like households are actually starting to expect some income gains. So perhaps we're starting to see some of the fruits of this tightening in the labor market in terms of household behavior. So overall, we are expecting households to start spending again in the second quarter. in part because of the strength of the labor market. Now, we did have a disappointing March payroll report, which was only 98,000 jobs created last month. We think that was a weather aberration. The timely data on jobless claims actually kind of spiked around the time when that jobless that jobs number was taken for March. So we do think that the improvement we've seen recently suggests the labor market still looks pretty healthy. One wild card, I think, for the consumption outlook longer term is what's going to happen with tax policy. We are not penciling in a whole lot of boosts here for two reasons. One, we think the political path to tax cuts may be a little bit challenging. Certainly our DC office seems to think that. And secondly, it does seem like, at least if the president had his priorities fulfilled, that most of the tax cuts would go to, as you can see in that bottom chart, about half of the dollar value of the tax cuts under the president's plan would go to the top 1%, who are generally viewed as having probably a lower marginal propensity to consume this windfall, and probably would also likely view it as temporary, given kind of the political ping pong that's been played with upper income tax rates. So we're not really expecting that to boost consumer spending all that much. But overall, you know, we think the consumption picture looks pretty good for, again, at least the next few quarters. Turning to housing, construction, as you can see on the left-hand side, is still well below pre-crisis levels. Of course, pre-crisis levels were associated with rising inventories of unsold homes, so that's not necessarily the benchmark we want to go for. Even so, we think gains in housing starts are probably going to be only moderate from here going forward, in part because we are seeing less household formation. As you can see on the right-hand side, this is the living situation of, I guess these would be called millennials, 25 to 34-year-olds, and consistent with all the stories you hear, as you can see with that orange line, the share of people in that age group living in their parents' households continues to move higher. I think, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, people thought, well, this will, you know, reverse itself as the labor market improves. But over those 2, 3, or 4 years, we've seen the jobless rate go nothing but down, including for this subgroup of the labor market. So there does seem to be something perhaps more cultural going on there than just a bad economy keeping down household formation. Let me just say a word about capital spending. It's been pretty disappointing in both 2015 and 2016. We think a big part of that was related to the downturn in energy prices. Capital spending, at least in as measured in the U.S., is reported by product rather than by industry. But the products that tend to be most closely associated with the oil and gas industry accounted for much of the downturn in capital spending over the past few years. We do have a decent chunk of first quarter data on capital spending in, and it looks like we're probably poised for a rebound to mid-single digits growth in overall capital spending. So we think a lot of the damage there is behind us and arguably getting a little better, at least in the near term. In part, we've also seen profits, which you can see on the left-hand side, are coming back in part because a lot of that is being driven by the energy sector as well. And sentiment indicators, of course, on the right-hand side have improved for both manufacturing and the non-manufacturing sector. Manufacturing has been doing great over the last 3 to 6 months globally. It's been doing great here in the U.S. So there, the surge in the sentiment seems more consistent with what we're seeing in the hard data. It seems more consistent with a global story, we think, than with an election story. So that, I don't think there's too much of a mystery as to what's going on there. I'm going to skip this chart. It's a little out of the way. I guess I should say, even though this is focused on the U.S., a few words about the global picture. We are feeling a little less, as a U.S. economist, challenged by the global outlook. One reason is, as you can see on the left-hand side, since the beginning of the year, the broad trade-weighted dollar has actually declined by about 4%. So some of that run-up that we saw both after the election as well as over the prior 2.5 years, we think some of those effects are starting to fade, and we are seeing better growth, as you can see on the right-hand side in both imports and exports. And generally speaking, we're feeling better about the external picture. We got Chinese GDP data over the weekend, which was good. Brazilian data came in yesterday, which was actually looking better. And I guess I should say that, you know, you see on the upper right-hand side that share of our exports that goes to all others, 75%. About a third of our exports go to China and, to Mexico and Canada. Canadian data has looked great over the past few quarters, and Mexico, the outlook is starting to pick up as well, at least over the past month or two. So overall, we're feeling one of the rare times in the past few years where the outlook domestically is not facing a big challenge from what we're seeing overseas. Obviously, we could create our own problems in terms of trade policy. That has been, I think, for every economist, we've put that in the tail risk category of something that could go wrong, particularly if we were to have kind of large scale across the board tariffs. For what it's worth, as you can see here, industries that tend to export also tend to import a lot. And so we don't think you're going to see among domestic constituents arguing for a more aggressive trade posture, export-intensive industries. So hopefully we can dodge this risk. But it does remain something that we are, while generally pretty sanguine about the next year or two, this remains something that you know, we worry about a little. So now let me turn to the supply side of the economy, and some of this is going to echo the previous presentation. On the left-hand side, and again, this comes back to the arithmetic that was described there, you add this and you add that, you pretty much get trend growth. The last 5 years, we've been averaging non-farm business productivity growth of 0.7%. And we expect, along with census, that resident working age population of around 0.5% or so, again, with a little more than half of that coming from the foreign-born segment. So, so the picture there does not look good in terms of trend growth, and this does get you to around 1%. We are projecting a little bit of a pickup in productivity growth, but not with a whole lot of conviction, because we don't see a whole lot of reasons in the near term why productivity growth should pick up. Now, why has productivity growth been weak? There's a lot of theories out there. We tend to align with one of those theories, which is most popularly associated with Robert Gordon, which is basically a slowdown in tech advancement. So first, on the right-hand side, this is capital equipment as a share of GDP divided into both tech and non-tech. As you can see, that gold line, which is non-tech or orange, whatever it is, has come down recently. Again, most of that is because of the energy sector. But generally speaking, what you see there is that the levels of non-tech investment as a share of GDP don't look particularly weak compared to the standards of the past few cycles. What does look weak is spending on IT equipment, which has just continued to kind of grind lower. So we don't think, you know, an animal spirit story explains this well, because it would be kind of odd that animal spirits would hold back one form of investment rather than another. Rather, we think that the user cost of tech equipment is not declining as fast as it did in the past. And on the left-hand side is computer, one type of tech equipment, but an important type, which is computers. And these are constant quality or hedonically adjusted prices relative to overall GDP prices on a two-year average basis. And you can see in the late 90s, real quality adjusted computer prices were declining over 25% per year, whereas more recently, those are declining mid-single digits. So if the market for computers is competitive, this should equate to a slower degree of advancement in the frontier of of technology embodied in that equipment. And so we do think this is consistent with a Gordon-type story that suggests technology that at least as usable for producing business output may not be advancing as fast. And we think two other facts are somewhat consistent with that, which is one that was already mentioned previously on the right-hand side is on, if you look at the G10 over, you know, long horizons, you've seen slowdowns in productivity growth everywhere. And also, if you look across, and this is for the U.S. on the left-hand side, similar long horizons, you've seen productivity slow down in almost every industry except for mining, which is dominated by oil and gas. That's only 1.5% of around 1.5% of value added in the nation. So almost every industry you've seen slowdowns in productivity as well, which, you know, would be consistent with a slowing and a general purpose technology that affects a lot of these industries, and we think tech kind of fits that bill. So case isn't dispositive, but we think it's pretty convincing that this is a likely reason for why we've been having poor productivity experiences over the past 10 years. And also I would add to that I think most statistical break tests for when productivity slowed would point to some point prior to the recession, so 2004, 2005, which again I think is a little bit at odds with a story that speaks to a recession hangover story, but I think it is more consistent with a Gordon-type tech story. Just following up on the earlier remark on immigration reform, that obviously is a downside risk to overall potential growth. It also could be quite disruptive at a micro level for certain industries, as you can see on the right, at least according to the Pew Research Center, which most people I think regard as being having the best data on unauthorized immigrants. You're seeing, you know, in places like construction, about an eighth of workers may be undocumented. So that I think there are some disruptive effects you could also have as well. So let me just turn back, shifting from the supply side story to the labor market, and then I'll try and wrap up. Probably already gone over time. Unemployment recently at 4.5%. You know, our guess, which is I think what it should be called rather than an estimate of the neutral natural rate, is around 5%. Most people don't have a natural rate estimate for the U6, the broad measure of underutilization. But even that has improved to levels that historically are consistent with full employment. So the U6 includes discouraged workers, marginally attached labor force, and part-time. Right now, we think most of that is solely due to part-time for economic reasons. So, which may be a little odd because the labor force participation rate has come down so much that one would think that discouraged workers are, you know, an exceptionally large share of the population, but it just doesn't seem to be the case. And on the participation rate is measured as everyone 16 and over who is looking for a job or has a job. There's no cutoff point, and so the population that is over 65%, which is generally going to have a lower participation rate, we think is holding down the average. And actually, as we look at prime age, which is 25 to 54, for both men and women, recent developments seem to be along the lines of trends fitted to the decade prior to the recession. And overall, as you look on the right-hand side, when we take trends that prevailed prior to the recession and extend them with the weights of the changing shares of the population, the participation rate that currently prevails looks consistent with that. And we're not the only ones to do this type of exercise on the right-hand side, but I think generally they all show a similar picture. We don't find a whole lot of responsiveness of the participation rate as well to changes or to the level of unemployment. So we do think, you know, there is a relationship there, so there may be some benefits from the high-pressure labor market. We just don't expect them to be massive. One thing we were a little surprised by in terms of the number of people working part-time for economic reasons is that there may be something to this story that the 30-hour-a-week cutoff could explain part of the increase. And part of the reason is that, as you can see on the right-hand side, there does seem to be an increase in the number who are kind of just under the threshold of that 30-hour cutoff. So we estimate maybe about a quarter of that may be due to employers pushing employees into part-time schedules. Regardless, we do think that the evidence is consistent with a tightening labor market. On the left-hand side is several measures of wage growth, which can be all over the map. I think if you take a first principle component of these, what you get is that wages, which had been averaging around 2% now are averaging closer to 2.5, 2.5 to 2.75. So we do think there is evidence that we're starting to see some of the fruits of a tighter labor market. And we think with productivity growth, the trend there maybe being 1%-ish, that the right bogey for nominal wage growth consistent with price stability is going to be closer to 3% rather than, you know, the 4% that I think most of us grew up kind of expecting to be normal. And turning to the inflation story, core inflation has firmed, at least it had until Friday. we got a really big surprise on Friday when very few people were in the office. Some of us had to come in. So that does give us a little bit of breathing room, I think, on the inflation picture, which had been firming. And our estimate based on that that inflation print is that the core PCE deflator, which in February was 1.75% on a year-ago basis, in March probably eases back down to 1.60%. So we do think that gives the Fed a little bit of breathing room. I don't want to get too much into that print, but it's been hotly debated on in certain parts of Manhattan. So turning from inflation naturally to the Fed and then wrapping up, our view is that the Fed hikes in June and September, and then that they try to start the balance sheet, if the economy lets them, in December. It does seem like there is a push here to kind of get the process started while Yellen is still Fed chair. As most of you probably know, Yellen's term expires in February of next year. Stan Fisher's term expires in June. Tarullo already left. So even with Quarles' potential nomination, you're going to have potentially another four vacancies. So that adds a lot of uncertainty here. But we do think there is a fair degree of certainty for this year, again, if the economy behaves and they can start this normalization process for the balance sheet in December, have it in place so that it's going to be, I think, hard to amend that once the process is agreed on by the committee as a whole. As the Fed behind the curve, they keep publicly asking themselves this, so it clearly is on their mind. And I think it's an interesting question. As you can see from this Dornbush quote, none of the post-war expansions died of old age. They were all murdered by the Fed. Usually they were murdered not because the Fed's malicious, but because the Fed gets behind the curve and has to get ahead of the curve, and in doing that usually sends the economy into a downturn. So the argument there is, well, we're at full employment, wage growth is picking up, core inflation's close to target. Well, we're getting a little bit of some breathing room here from last Friday's number, which again is going to stay in the year-ago prints up until next year. The Taylor rules, to the extent one believes those, show the Fed's behind the curve. But, you know, as I say, you do get some breathing room, not only from the recent inflation print, but from low inflation expectations. Now, if we did get fiscal policy that was deficit financed, we think that would increase these inflation risks and put the Fed behind the curve. So that doesn't seem like it's something that we would advocate, at least fiscal policy that simply is meant to, or simply results in an augmentation of aggregate demand. So with that, I guess I will skip some of these other charts and just wrap it up there.
Thank you. And next we'll hear from Mikolas Nikeforos with the Levy Institute.
So, good morning. My name is Michalis Nikiforos. I'm a research scholar here at the Levy Institute. And I want to present today a recent policy report, a report that was published last year on the state and the prospects of the U.S. economy. The report is co-authored with my colleague Gennaro Zezza, who is in Italy, and he could not be here today. Let me just say before I begin that you know, the character of this report is has a more is more of a medium-term analysis, and that's why this series of policy papers are called strategic analysis. So it's neither a short-term forecast or a super very long-term forecast as well. So let me start this way. Michael showed a similar graph. These are the post-war recoveries of the U.S. economy. The difference here is that this graph is from trough to peak in every recovery. The last three recoveries are with colors. The red one is the current recovery, and the gray lines show all the previous post-war recoveries. So it's striking how the last three recoveries of the U.S. economy are on the lower side of every previous post-war recovery. And the current recovery is the slowest recovery among all post-war recoveries in the United States. So from that point of view, and if we observe the red line, 2016 was another, let's say, normal year in the post-war, post-crisis period in the United States. We had a very slow growth, but along this trend that has dominated since 2009. And this is the recovery of the employment to population ratio. We can see here again that the current recovery has been by far the slowest in the post-war period, and it was only during 2016 that the employment to population ratio reached its level of 2009. So it took more than 7 years for the employment population ratio to return to its 2009 level. 2016 was also kind of a normal year in the post-crisis period, in the sense that all the conventional forecasts were forecasting that a pickup in growth. So every year since 2009, the conventional forecast are saying, well, this is going to be the year that the growth rate in the U.S. Will pick up. And it was not also normal in the sense that this didn't happen. So the U.S. economy continued to grow, but at a very modest rate. On our behalf, we have been more cautious in our forecast, and in several of our previous reports, we have identified three main structural problems of the U.S. economy, which are impediments to a robust and sustainable recovery. And these three major problems are the high income inequality in the United States, the weak demand for net exports, and the fiscal conservatism that has prevailed in the U.S. over the last decades. And why is that? If an economy faces weak net export demand and at the same time there is restrictive fiscal policy, then economic growth becomes dependent on rising private borrowing, and then growth can be the result only of a rise in private expenditure relative to income, and thus an increase in the debt-to-income ratio of the private sector, especially the household sector. And because of rising inequality, this increase in the debt-to-income ratio falls unevenly on households at the bottom of the distribution. And because the growth process is so much dependent on increasing indebtedness of the private sector, then it also becomes dependent on asset inflation. So the Main Street is at the mercy of the Wall Street to an unusual extent. So this process describes the path of the U.S. economy towards the crisis. So before the crisis, the U.S. economy managed to grow because the private sector, especially the household sector, was accumulating more and more and more debt. But these structural problems also explain why the recovery has been so slow, because of the fragile condition of the balance sheet of the household sector. The households have tried to deleverage, and they have not been willing to increase their indebtedness since the crisis. And that's why we've been on this very slow growth path since 2009. So just to make these points a little bit more clear, this is the same graph for consumption in the U.S. recovery. Not surprisingly, since consumption is the biggest share of GDP, we can observe the same path. And this is where inequality plays a major role, because increasing inequality means that a redistribution of income from households with a low propensity to consume, from households with high propensity to consume to households with low propensity to consume. So ceteris paribus, this leads to lower growth in consumption and lower growth in GDP. Now, the usual the usual argument against this is that, well, we shouldn't talk about inequality because at the end of the day, investment will pick up, growth will be created, and everybody, you know, the profits are going to trickle down and everybody will be better off. However, if we look at investment in this graph, we see that, again, the performance of investment during the current recovery has been disappointing. Actually, investment has stagnated for the last 3 years. Real investment has not increased at all in the last 3 years. And in fact, 2016 was the first year in this recovery that the growth rate of investment was negative. Over the last three decades, the only years with negative growth rate in investment were 1990 and 1991, 2001 and 2002, and the years 2007, 2008, and 2009, all clustered, you know, around downturns in the United States. This graph very clearly shows how fiscal conservatism has been a major drag on growth in the United States. The red line shows that the current recovery has been the only recovery in the post-war history of the United States that the real government expenditure has been, the growth in real government expenditure has been negative. So the growth rate, the real government expenditure now is lower compared where it was 7 years ago. And finally, to go to the to exports and imports, again, we see here how exports have been another major drag on the U.S. growth. Again, we see here that, is this? Yeah. So exports, real exports, essentially have been flat since early 2014 for the last almost 3 years. Now, the trade deficit has not increased that much because imports have not grown as well. And the reason for that, the major reason for that is this new extraction methods related with fracking, that they have reduced a lot imports of petroleum and related products of the U.S. economy, and obviously it's also related to the slow growth in the United States economy. So what is our baseline scenario? Our usual practice in these reports is to build our baseline scenario around the forecasts of the CBO's budget and economic outlook, which is published in January of every year. So the reason for that is simple, because CBO provides a forecast for a macroeconomic forecast and also a fiscal forecast. So the idea is that we build a baseline scenario that examines what are the conditions necessary for the CBO projections to materialize. And the CBO projections this year, you can see them in this table. The CBO is projecting a very modest decrease in government deficit in the next couple of years, and then a modest decrease in the deficit, and then a modest increase back to 3.2% in 2020. And here, with regards to the growth rate, a very small increase in the growth rate to 2.3% in 2017 to 2% in 2018. And then the growth rate converges to 1.6%, more or less, which is what the CBO is calculates as the new, let's say, natural growth rate. This is where the U.S. economy converges to. So the last 2 years are determined from the supply side. The CBO projections this year are interesting for the reason that they are that compared to the previous publications of the CBO are very pessimistic. So as I said, in all the previous years, we were very cautious when we were discussing the CBO projections for the simple reason that for the CBO projections to materialize in the previous year, you needed a very large increase in the indebtedness of the private sector, of the household sector, to support this kind of growth rates. And here are the CBO projections, for example, in the last 4 years. You see how the CBO was projecting in 2014 that the growth rate would be between 3 and 3.5%. There is a slight decline. What we see here is that this year's projections are basically around the post-crisis average of the U.S. economy. And this is something that we also see with our model. Like when we try to simulate the CBO projections and when we try to see, well, what are the necessary conditions for these projections to materialize, we see basically that we have a continuation of this post-crisis trend. These are the financial balances of the three sectors of the U.S. economy. This is the trajectory of government deficit that is projected by the CBO. And here we see that the private sector slowly, the financial balance of the private sector slowly decreases along its post-2013 trend. And the current account deficit also slowly decreases and reaches 4% by 2020. But there is nothing. The CBO projections are basically some kind of a business as usual projections. So business as usual, at least in the post-crisis period. This is another graph which shows what's going to happen to the household and the corporate debt to GDP ratio. We see that the household sector, again, the debt to GDP ratio of the household sector is flat. The non-financial corporations continue to accumulate debt. The only difference is that our econometrics show that, and I think it's pretty much everybody agrees with that, that the corporate debt does not really support aggregate demand. It has been kind of decoupled from investment, while the household debt is very much linked to consumption and thus growth. So this has been the situation over the last 7-8 years, and these are our baseline projections. The new president promised before the election and has kept promising after the elections that he will change that. He will make the American economy great again, and he will implement economic policy that will lead to a pickup in growth. And if we want to summarize the most important of the economic proposals of the new administration, they include the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. This is already not happening. An investment of $1 trillion over 10 years in public infrastructure projects, tax cuts for corporations and households, reduction of the government deficit, and aggressive renegotiation of trade agreements and reform of taxation policy to reduce the trade deficit. Now, even a casual look at this list shows some very fundamental contradictions. So it's really hard to see how the government deficit will be reduced, and at the same time you will have an investment of $1 trillion and tax cuts. Obviously, this can happen if you have a massive reversal in the current account, but this is anyway not very likely. Anyway, the financial markets have totally bought it. They have reacted very nicely. We had a very nice run in the stock market after November. However, again, we are a little bit more cautious, and we think that the proper question to ask here is, to what extent is this optimism warranted, and to what extent the policy proposals and the policy measures of the new administration can solve the three fundamental structural problems of the U.S. economy that I talked about before, that we have identified. So we can start, very briefly talk about these three issues. So what about fiscal conservatism? Will the new administration be less fiscally conservative than the previous administrations? It's hard to see how this is going to happen. So, for example, the new director of the budget office of the White House is one of the most fiscally conservative politicians in Washington right now. And the first budget proposal of the new administration that was published a few weeks ago does not foresee any fiscal expansion. And also, the recent negotiations in Congress about the new healthcare bill show that the fiscally conservative wing of the Republican Party has gained unprecedented leverage. So it's hard to see how the new administration will be less fiscally conservative. And actually, the new budget proposal is a good example. There is an increase in the budget. There is an increase in the expenses for defense. And then to compensate for this increase in expenses for defense, there is an across-the-board decrease in spending for many other things. But in a way, the fiscal philosophy of the new administration reminds this Gantz versus Butter model that people would study in their undergraduate courses of economics. So they increase the budget for Gantz and they decrease the budget for everything else. Now, this zero-sum character of fiscal decisions will obviously have negative impact on income inequality as well, which is the first of the problems that I talked about before. We already see that in the new budget proposals. The increase in the defense spending is compensated by cuts in a series of programs that benefit middle and lower income households. And income inequality will also be affected if the contemplated tax reform is successfully negotiated. So for the moment, it seems that there are two Republican plans for tax reform. The first is the plan of Paul Ryan. According to some studies, if this plan goes through, 99.6% of the tax cuts will benefit the wealthiest 1% of the population in the U.S. There is a plan that has been proposed by the new president. According to this, to the Trump plan, it will only be 50% of the tax cut that will benefit the wealthiest 1%, only 50%. Actually, the other 50% will also go to the top decile of income distribution, and only a very small fraction will go to the middle class. So also based on the first evidence of the new administration, income inequality is not going to improve. If anything, there is going to be a further deterioration in inequality in the United States. Related to these two, there is, one of the key proposals of Trump or Mr. Trump before the elections has been this $1 trillion infrastructure investment over a time horizon of 10 years. If you read previous papers that we have written, we have argued repeatedly in favor of a large public infrastructure investment plan. And we believe that such a plan will be beneficial first because of its direct effects on aggregate demand, but also because of indirect effects on increasing productivity and increasing the competitiveness of the U.S. economy. However, it seems now that the promise investment plan will be a plan of tax cuts for corporations that engage in infrastructure investment. And this kind of plan is clearly inferior compared to a plan of direct government expenditure. And why is that? Because a big portion of the tax cuts will be tied to public works that would materialize in any case. So both the direct and the indirect effect of such a tax cuts plan will be inferior in terms of promoting growth and employment. And also, given the desired fiscal neutrality of the government, such a plan would also have negative side effects on income inequality. It's also not clear what proportion of this plan would made up of projects to increase border security, which I think we can agree that they will not have a very positive effect on productivity growth. But in any case, for the moment, the only concrete infrastructure-related measure that has been proposed by the new administration is the reduction of the Department of Transportation spending by 13%. So this is the only thing that we have seen so far, which obviously will have very negative effects on infrastructure spending. The last trademark promise of the new administration is an aggressive trade policy to reduce trade deficit. We believe that, in theory at least, such a policy could have some effect on reducing the trade deficit in the United States. There are two problems with that. The first one is that it's very unlikely that the U.S. trading partners will not react to aggressive policy measures. So it's almost sure that if the U.S. unilaterally imposes tariffs or border adjustment taxes and so on, the U.S. trading partners will respond with their own tariffs and their own taxes. So the effect will be lower than what one would expect on a ceteris paribus assumption. The second reason why one should be skeptical about the effectiveness of these measures is that the underlying analysis is based on a kind of a Ricardian view of trade, where we have one good produced, we have wine produced in Portugal, we have cloth produced in England. Well, if England imposes tariffs on Portuguese imports, these imports are going to decrease. The problem, and again, Michael showed a graph, is that nowadays trade takes place along integrated value chains. So one good is produced in one country, is then exported to another country where it's used as an intermediate good in the production of another good, which is then exported to a third country or back to the first country. And if one looks at the data, a big portion of U.S. imports from Mexico and China is made up of this kind of intermediate capital goods. So in this case, the imposition of tariffs or border adjustment taxes has uncertain effects. And clearly, the effects are going to be lower than one would expect if we were living in a Ricardian world. The last thing why we are skeptical about the effectiveness of the proposals of the new administration is that it is unlikely that they will manage to go through Congress. and it is unlikely that they will accommodate the conflicting interests of the two principal factions within the Republican majority. And I guess the case of the healthcare bill is telling. On the one hand, there was the conservative wing of the Republican Party that was finding that this new bill was too was not conservative enough, and then there was the more centrist wing of the party that was finding that the new bill was too strict. So someone can imagine similar problems with most of the new administration's proposed measures. So to sum up, it's hard to see how the proposals, the policy proposals of the new administration will do something to significantly change the course of the U.S. economy. If anything, because of the very negative impact of these proposals on income inequality, the situation is going to get worse. But in any case, the financial markets, 5 minutes, have reacted very favorably, and the stock market has increased 12% in only 4 months. The new president recently boasted that the stock market had gained $3.2 trillion since his election. And this last run, this run that started in November, started from an already elevated level in the stock market. So as of April, as of yesterday, the S&P 500 index stood at 2,350 points, and this is a 350% inflation compared to its trough in March of 2009. Over the same period, output prices, output inflation, has been only 13%. So asset inflation since November is more or less the same as the output inflation since the March of 2009. If Hyman Minsky was here, he would tell us that, you know, the asset prices and the output prices cannot diverge forever. Looking at the stock market from another point of view, here are two graphs of the ratio of the market capitalization to gross domestic income and the net operating surplus. Looking at the market capitalization like this, we see that it is now at a higher level compared both to the late 90s and 2007. Or if we normalize the market prices to the earnings of the firms, we see here that this Shiller P/E ratio is now close to 30. The only periods in the past that the Shiller P/E ratio was that high was in the late summer and the early fall of 1929 and the last couple of years of the 90s. And also the home prices have increased. So we see here 2016 was important in that sense because the index of the home prices caught up with its pre-crisis level. So now, based on this Case-Shiller index, the house prices are higher than they were before the crisis. So if we believe that there were asset bubbles in 2007 and in 2000, it's hard to see why these price levels are normal. So to evaluate what might happen to the U.S. economy, we simulate another scenario where the stock market falls in the second half of 2017 and the first half of 2018 and then stabilizes for the rest of the projection period. We simulate a fall of the S&P 500 index to around 1600, which is still above its pre-crisis levels in 2000 and 2007. And the fall in the stock market induces a second round of deleveraging, which lasts from the end of 2017 to the end of the projection period. In our simulations, this has a very negative impact, as one would expect, on the growth rate, which drops to minus 2% by 2019 and 2020. So just to sum up, the title of my presentation is this time different? And the answer is that, unfortunately, this time is not different. As I explained, achieving sustainable growth in the United States requires addressing its three fundamental problems: a decrease in income inequality, an improvement in the U.S. external position, and a relaxation of the government's fiscal stance. But if one examines the conditions of the new administration and its policy proposals, one can conclude that it is unlikely that the new administration will be able to solve any of these problems. If anything, things will get worse. And finally, as I explained in my last few slides, asset markets pose a threat for the economy, and the reversal could be triggered by other reasons, which I don't have the time to discuss right now, so I will leave it for the Q&A part of the session. Thank you.